I'm so excited to have you here, David. Thank you so much for finding the time this morning to chat with us.
Pumi, it is wonderful to be here. Absolutely wonderful.
You have to tell me, first and foremost, because this is not your first book, why this book at this time?
I tell you why, because it struck me just before the pandemic that I had spent 30 years as an economist in the central bank in Ireland, in investment banking, in all sorts of areas, and then in journalism. And it struck me, I've spent about 30 odd years trying to understand the relationship between money and humanity. That's really when it broke down. And I thought, okay, first thing is, do economists, my tribe, understand money? And I've come to the conclusion they don't. They don't understand the totality of money, what money does to us, right? So the premise of the book is that money is humanity's most impressive technology. And we came up with this technology around 5,000 years ago in domesticated societies. But even prior to that in Africa, we have evidence of money about 20,000 years ago from Congo. So then the idea was, hold on a second, what does this thing do to us? What is this thing? Can it run out? Where does it come from? And then you realize that money was invented by humans, I believe, to deal with the complexity of a world when we stopped being hunter-gatherers and we started settling down in little small towns and villages, started to deal with people. We needed to come up with rules. We needed to come up with hierarchies, with evaluations, with really odd notions. And then what really intrigued me was that when you think about money, it doesn't exist. That's the mad thing. So money is a figment of the human imagination at its most sophisticated, because underpinning it is this idea of value, which again is entirely subjective. So what I was trying to do was say, man, hold on a second. You've got this crazy technology. And every time we see innovations in this technology, we see innovations and propulsions forward in human civilization. So the book is basically about the relationship between a clever ape, us, and a wonderful technology, money. And therefore it brings us literally from the Stone Age to Bitcoin. And that, it was one of those books, it was going to be small, and then the pandemic happened and I had nothing to do. So I decided, let's go and write a bigger book.
Dude, this book fuses something I am deeply interested in, which is history. The history of humans and all of the interlocking parts of it. And money. And it's such a clever way of looking at history. Yes. I thought the way that you've laid it out. I mean, it's incredibly clever. And throughout the book, there's a lot of the biggest theme that I see is the wash, rinse, and repeat of it all. It's cyclical, right?
Yeah.
it's about elites and how they control money and how they control society and influence and all of that. And I'm wondering, in today's digital world, as you watch it unfold now, do you think we're just at the beginning of a new iteration of this cycle, or is this really a divergence in this technology?
No, I think it's a really interesting question, because what struck me while I was writing the book was that we have had many innovations in money. And the fascinating thing about money, I come up with this expression that humans used to be what we called, for the first 400,000 years, we were called, our anthropologists call us, a pyrophyte species. So we were a species that was actually completely and utterly dominated by our ability to use fire, what fire did to us, so it changed our digestive system, our faces, everything. And I was just in Kruger National Park, and I was thinking about that yesterday when I was sitting there, and there's lions, and I said, that's what it used to look like. And the animal in this bush that could control fire won the game, became the top dog. And what you see, therefore, is that for the first 400,000 years, we were pyrophyte nation or pyrophyte species. I came up with this word, so you won't see it in the dictionary, called the last 5,000 years, we have become a plutophyte species, which is a species that constantly adapts to and is adapted by our relationship with money. So if fire was the foundational technology of the first 400,000 years of humanity, money is the foundational technology of the last 5,000 years. And then when you look at it this way, what you see is every change in the world around us is reflected in a change in money, as if money presupposes changes or sometimes suggests changes. So when you go from coins, for example, how did that come in? So people talk about the digital world and say, oh my God, it's all new. No, it's not. It's just another iteration of human evolution. Now, where it takes us is kind of interesting. But the point of the book is to say every single generation or every single big epochal change in humanity has been associated with a change in money. So now we're talking about the digital age, right? Now people are saying it's going to change the world. We've been in the digital age for every time you tap your phone, you're in the bloody digital age. You know, you get these sort of tech nerds coming on and going, hey, gee whiz, the world is changing. No, it's not, man. It's just changing, right? Okay. My kids don't use cash, right? They also don't watch national television. So there's all sorts of changes. So the point is, yes, money will change as the digital age changes. But the most important thing is that money needs to solve a problem. So the reason the humans have got to the top of the tree is we're very good problem solvers. So then when you look at digital coins and you look at, for example, crypto, you think, well, what problem is this thing solving? And if there's no evident basis of a problem, then what it is, it's just an investment that'll go up and down. And part of it, you know, so we can go into that. But it's my sense is that money will adapt to the digital age simply because that's what it does.
Oh, I love the idea that money needs to solve a problem.
Yes.
Right. So we're currently talking astronomical numbers. We're talking the first trillionaires, right? Bernie Sanders says billionaires shouldn't exist.
Yeah, I think he says every billionaire is a policy failure, which is a really interesting point. So the interesting thing about money is we focus on the accumulation of money because it feeds into our sense of justice or lack of justice, etc. What the book is actually sometimes more about, now we'll answer the question, is not about the accumulation. I think money, in a way, doesn't change humanity. It amplifies basic characteristics. So if you are a greedy person.
Basic or base?
Base, okay, yeah. So if you are a greedy person, right, and that's where you come from, the chances are you will deploy money to amplify your greed. If you are a generous person, if you are a person who believes in humanity, what you'll see is many, many, many people are charitable, look out for their neighbours, and they deploy their wealth in a very positive way. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is you cannot have plutocracy and democracy hanging out together for too long. So basically the promise of democracy is one man, one vote, right? The promise of plutocracy is one guy, all the votes. Okay, right? Because I've got to get
buy the money, I'll buy the politician, I'll buy
everything, right? So you can have inequality and democracy marching side by side for a while, but eventually they are too aggressively inconsistent for this to happen. So when Bernie speaks, and the interesting thing is I'm actually on Bernie's think tank.
Oh, wow.
So I know him very well. So, and I've been over to his many events in Burlington. And I always say to Bernie, I said, Bernie, I'm not a lefty. And he says, yeah, but David, you see the world in a different way. So come on into the thing. But fascinatingly, Donald Trump in the last few days is unveiling Bernie-esque policies. So he's saying, we're going to tax the rich, the uber wealthy, and we're going to try and make drugs cheaper in the United States. That's Bernie's campaign. So fascinatingly, the right and the left are coming together on issues that are consistent with them. So I think that what we have is a system which has over the last 20 or 30 years created the conditions for its own destruction, which is if you allow too much money being held in the hands of too few people, history tells us that's how you react. You start with the French Revolution and you go from there. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the thing. So what I like about looking at money this way is that money has an ability to reveal as well as to hide. And what it reveals are basic problems within the system.
Well, in South Africa, we have this huge chasm between the rich and the poor. We also have a billionaire president who, in my view, has been the most disappointing of all presidents. And in fact, I think Donald Trump and our president have shown that business is not necessarily the solution to social problems. So a business leader is not necessarily a great political leader or statesman, as it were. And, you know, here in South Africa, we've got a lot of people who live in debt traps. We have a lot of people who are on social grants. Yes. And the way that they experience money or the lack thereof has quite a lot of impact on how they see the political system. And Completely. For the politicians who are astute, the rhetoric is that this global financial system has not been created or geared for poor people.
Okay, I'm gonna.
And I'm wondering, in your view, you know, what you think about the way that money has evolved, and how we can find a more just way of existing, particularly in our environment here in South Africa.
One of the fascinating things about looking at money and looking at inequality is this notion that poverty obliterates the future. So what struck me about, as a kid, you know, the people with money have got very long time horizons. People without money have no time horizon. And this is a completely different way of looking at it. So if you are poor, today is the most important thing. It's getting by.
Surviving,
right? If you are rich, or at least middle class, you know, your kids go to college. They're thinking about 5 years' time. You'd say to your, you know, I'd say to my children as a middle class, you go to college and then you can be this in 5 years' time. Mm-hmm. So your time horizon changes. So the difference between the rich and poor is a perception of time. And why is that? Is because the poor don't have a future, because poverty destroys the future.
It steals everything.
And therefore, this comes back to your people in debt. What you're trying to do is you're living day by day, what they call in Europe, you know, the sort of the payday loan situation where you've got very high interest rates for very poor people. The most extraordinary thing about interest rates is rich people pay...
Almost none.
Almost nothing. And poor people pay through the nose, right? So once you start doing that, you say, okay, how do we rebalance this system? How do we change this system? That's the first thing. The second thing about Ramaphosa and Trump, et cetera, is I think what we are seeing is a generational shift in global politics. I think it was interesting. I was down in Cape Town last week and I was looking at this rather obscure, tatty piece of the Berlin Wall, which is actually in the central business district, okay? And I think what the sculptor was trying to make was the connection between what happened in Europe and the world when the Berlin Wall fell and the subsequent release of Nelson Mandela, because the world shifted on its axis. Mm-hmm. And that allowed the Americans, who were terrified of communism, to say to the National Party here, listen lads, communism's over. So suddenly the ANC in Washington becomes less toxic and you get the whole change, right? That was the beginning of a 40-year cycle, I believe, which started around the Berlin Wall. Mandela's release was the iconic image of a change, and it was displayed all around the world. And now we're at the end of that period. But that period was globalization, free movement of capital, free movement of trade. It was the rise of China. It was this idea that Pax Americana would work, that they'd protect us all. And it was the idea that all the boats will rise and everything will be hunky-dory.
The rising tide.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen. In fact, what happened was within the seeds of this system were its own destruction. Why? Because after 2008, the global response to the crash was we will reduce interest rates. So, Pumi, when you think of interest rates, when you reduce interest rates, that pushes up the prices of assets. But who owns assets? Rich people or poor people? Rich people. That's why they're rich. They own stuff. Okay. People are poor. They don't own shit. Right? Okay. So if you bias your entire system to a monetary framework which jaundice says it's results towards richer people because you increase assets, so house prices, stock prices, anything that you get an income from that isn't work. You pit those people in the world and in South Africa who earn their daily crust from rents and dividends and wealth against those people who earn their daily crust from wages. Okay? And the problem is there's far more people in the world earning their crust from wages because that is their income, than the people with rents. And this is where we're at now. So I think one of the reasons we have this global anxiety and trade wars and is that we are shifting on a pivot between a 40 years, which largely started with Mandela being released. It was a much more interest. For South Africans, it's crucial. For the world, it was also crucial because it signaled a change in the old regime. And I think we're going into something quite new where America will be less important, China will be more important, and South Africa, but Africa in general, has to figure out how do we play this tectonic plate, which is shifting.
Africa in general. And in the book, you talk about the Congo.
Yes.
In a way that, even with my interest in history and politics, I've not looked at. And also, you know, contrasting. So when you talk about the Congo Free State.
Yes.
And you talk about kind of the Confederate South and how they were impoverished.
Yes.
Right? They're very similar, these two stories, because of how money was divvied and who had what to play with, right?
Yeah.
And by and large, even the Global South, you know, when you kind of look at how the impact of colonialism and how money shifted during that time and who had the right to plunder, the way we see poverty and the way that we see people who have historically lived from day to day and this tectonic shift that you're talking about, is there a way to recalibrate some of these past injustices, and what does that look like?
No, it's a fascinating question because we're going deep into areas which are psychological, emotional, as well as historical. I happen to come from the only European country that was ever a colony. So the Irish are weird. We're the only colony in Europe, right? Like, how bad do you have to be the only colony in Europe? How messed up, how chaotic, how disorganized, how pathetic that we were the only European country that was occupied by another country for hundreds of years. So we get that feeling of humiliation. We get the feeling, for example, when my mother, who is 90 years old, she's a school teacher, she's educated thousands of kids over her years. When she hears a posh English person speak, she thinks they're better than her.
Mm-hmm.
That's colonialism. That's something in her head that her mother said, we're not as good as those people, right? Mm-hmm. So these are deep, deep that you understand and we understand. That's the first thing. The second thing, the story of the Congo, if listeners are interested in it, is an abomination on a scale that I don't think we really understand, right? And it was a plunder of basically rubber from the Congo, but it turned into not a genocide, an absolute genocide. We think between 5 and 10 million people were killed in a 12-year period.
And millions more maimed.
Maimed. They cut off limbs. I mean, they were talking. And then, of course, you destroy the culture because you come in and you destroy what was a tribal culture.
Mm.
And how you destroy a tribal culture is you kill the bosses.
Mm.
And then the people have no leader and suddenly they become chattel, in effect. Mm. It's the story of a guy called Roger Casement, who was an Irish revolutionary who got hanged for treason. We don't think it's treason, but he was hanged for treason in 1916. But the American South story is part of the whole thing. And the American South story is part of the most unbelievably unjust trade triangle, which was called the Atlantic Triangle. And the Atlantic Triangle delivered second-rate goods to Africa, usually guns and trinkets. In return, those were sold for slaves. The slaves were transferred, so basically it was from England to West Africa, Sierra Leone, bizarrely, the title Freetown, the least free place in the world, but there you go. Those slaves were sent across, those African, they weren't slaves, they were African people were sent across to the Bahamas, to Barbados, to present-day Jamaica, and to the south of the United States. Far more sent to the Caribbean, actually, than sent to the America. And those people were sold for cotton and sugar and tobacco, and that went back to England. And that was called the Atlantic Triangle, and it was the underpinning of the global economy from around 1600 to about 1830. And it's amazing, and no one talks about it. So then you come back as how do poor countries get rich, which is our thing. How do you play the game? How do you find a niche? Bizarrely, our own country, Ireland, was a poor country that became very, well, relatively poor, that became relatively rich in a generation. Probably because we pretended to be Americans to the Europeans, right? Basically, the Irish economy is Connecticut with shitty weather, okay? You know, we're kind of adjacent to the Yanks.
But you've also got Guinness.
We've got Guinness and we've got lots of good stuff. It's a nice country. We've got good whiskey, we've got good Guinness, we've got nice people, we've decent music, all those sort of stuff. But
and basically Catholic.
And basically, yeah. Yeah. Which comes with its own refinements, darling. I can tell you all about that too, as you know.
But, I too am Catholic.
Right, okay, so you've got the madness. So we can form a self-help group later on, and me, okay, to go through our trauma.
All the this trauma upbringing. Is so shared.
Yeah, but just the guilt.
This is my point. This is also the thing, right? Who would have thunk it that small black girl from Soweto and Irish David from all the way on the other side of the ocean, really, so much in common, and yet still we find so many things that divide us. And money is one of the
money
biggest ones.
Is one of them. But if you look, so the essential promise of money is that you can change your position. This is why it's so revolutionary. This is why rich people are so afraid of it, actually, if you think about it. Because in the book, I go back all the way to the Sumerians, the Lydians, the early Greeks, the Romans. These guys were playing with money and they were changing the way they thought. And there's a chapter on why, for example, the Greek mind changed when it did and how it did and where it did. And I think it's because they became a numerate society with money. I also think of why did Christianity, talk about Catholicism, like why did this guy Jesus turn up when he did, where he did, with that message?
A revolutionary.
Exactly. And why was the message landing? Fertile? Why was it fertile? Why did it actually land? Because the new monetary economy that the Greeks and the Greek world had created exactly what we're talking about, which is the idea that some people who were good with money could ascend socially. And therefore they began to think, well, then it's me. I'm the man. This is a meritocracy. And I'm talking back in the Jesus' time. So the people who lost out in the monetary economy, they needed a countervailing story, a narrative to make them feel good when they go to bed. And this guy comes in, and the amazing thing about Jesus, imagine how radical this idea is. In a world where the previous gods were like Zeus and Prometheus, they were like big macho guys. Like imagine Elon Musk with wings, right? This is what these people were like, okay, right? And this dude comes around and he says, "No, the meek, they'll inherit the earth. The weak guy is the strong guy." And that is a radical message that must.
Blessed are they.
It must, yeah, exactly. But it must have had resonance. So let's go forward to somewhere like South Africa and think, okay, the problem, it seems to me, that South Africa has economically is you have an extractive industry based around mining, which everybody in Joburg understands, and you have a service industry, which you've no manufacturing. And if you look at the history of industrialized countries, start with Britain in the 18th century, it had manufacturing. Germany in the 19th century, manufacturing. America in the 20th century, manufacturing. Japan in the late 20th century, manufacturing. China now, right? You need to have this manufacturing base to generate what we call the productivity to produce the goods. And the thing about manufacturing is you can fuse it with technology to make one person much more productive. In services, you can't do that. So you can't cut 100 heads of hair at the same time.
It's all that's in your brain. Exactly. It's the time that you can apply to a task.
So South Africa, I believe, can look at a model, something like Ireland did. So Ireland had, when I was a kid, we had no capital and lots of labor. Okay? So we had no money and lots of people. So we exported people, right? Mm. Because we had no jobs. Right. So how do you go from a society that had no capital and lots of people to a society now that hasn't got enough people and has got loads of money? What do you do? What's the trick? Mm-hmm. And the trick that the Irish played was that we said to the Americans, look, we have no industrial base, we have no capital, we have no money in effect. Why don't we make your money cheap for you guys to spend here? And they said, well, how do you do that? Well, we won't tax it as much as you do at home. And then suddenly you begin the process whereby the Americans bring their manufacturing industry to you. And in this case, you overleap two or three generations of development. So if you think about Africa, right, in 2021, 6 out of every 10 babies will be African in the world. You are the future. We're not the future. You guys are the future. This continent is the future. So if South Africa can have a strategic plan for the next 50 years, to say, we are going to suck in the capital from other countries, particularly the Americans and the Chinese, because they need access to this market because that's where the growth is. And the Chinese are getting older more quickly than even the Europeans, than even us, because the one-child policy meant they've no kids, right?
Yeah, and that's been a 50-year project.
So now they're old.
Generation.
So now, and if you go to China, you realize this is an old, this is, the warning from China is Japan. Japan has run out of people, right? Okay. So the only place with the people
is Africa.
It's here. Wow. Okay. It's here. You know, you talked about Soweto. I went to Nelson Mandela's house yesterday and I just went for a stroll around that area. You know, it's kids. It's kids everywhere, right? You don't see that.
Average age, median age in Africa is around 14, I think. The last time I saw it in South Africa, our median age is 26.
Well, I can feel that here. You can feel it in the street. So then you think, okay, how do we turn this alleged disadvantage into an advantage? How do we turn the fact that our demographic profile is incredibly popular, or so incredibly positive, number one, and two, that our continent, of which we are the single biggest power with the Nigerians, if you take this, is where the growth rate of the world is going to come from. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing about ideology is ideology can really destroy us because it's too rigid. It's, the world is messy because humans are messy. Like, we're messy creatures, you know? What goes on in our heads is so messy, okay? We all know that. You only show the world a little bit of your personality, okay? And all the other mad stuff, whoa, you know, that's not for public consumption, okay? But the economy is messy because we are messy. Evolution is messy because we are messy. Mm. So if you apply strict ideological rules taken from some book that some guy with a beard wrote 150 years ago, or somebody else.
100 years before the first car was even manufactured. Yeah,
exactly, exactly.
Just nobody specific
comes to mind
whose last name starts with an M.
Exactly. But if you start with that dude, right? Okay, okay. Or whoever else is your cup of tea, whoever else is your intellectual mentor. Mm-hmm. And they come at you, which is kind of a like Moses with a book with 10 commandments. In effect, this is how you should live, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And you try to apply that in a uniform, blunt fashion to society, you're going to lose. You're just going to lose, right? And then you get really aggressive and then you point your finger, you're not pure enough for us, et cetera, et cetera. So what I think is, look at one or two countries that have done this successfully. Then you think, okay, so what do the Asians do? How did they get so rich? Because we know that South Korea had the same GDP as Mali in 1962. Now South Korea is one of the most successful countries in the world, and we know that because it's winning Oscars. So it's moved even from manufacturing
into a cultural
culture. The South Koreans are exporting culture, which is an extraordinary change, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's, how do they do it? And you know, there are ways and means of doing this that if you follow these countries, at least you have a chance. But if you come in and you have a kleptocracy of people taking money and state capture and blah, 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 and then the Americans wagging their finger at you and giving you, that's not kosher when it comes to development.
You know, the thing about you and this book in particular is an immense capacity for telling strange stories. Right? Which is like, no one thinks an economist does that, right? We have a particular view of what economists are and how they are and how they think. And when I was reading this book, like, I love The Wizard of Oz. I did not know that story about The Wizard of Oz. And so you have to tell it a little bit if you can find, because I can't find a way of praising it. I thought about how would I praise it. I wanted it to be the opening sequence of this show, but I didn't know how. So you're going to have to give us a quick summary of the story of The Wizard of Oz and why it's this money allegory. But also, I'm wondering, when you were writing and researching this book, are there any other gems that changed the way you were thinking about money when you came across them?
Loads, loads. This for me was a re-education. As I said to you before, I graduated, did a master's in economics. Then I went to work in our central bank, which is the kind of holy of holies. You know, exactly. It's like you're almost becoming a priest, right? It's like
a Brahmin.
Yeah, a Brahmin. Well, exactly. And you're a member of the Brahmin class, right? So people look to you, and then suddenly you end up, then you work in the central bank, you go to investment banking, now I'm a professor in Trinity in Dublin teaching kids. And you realize that it's probably only human, but most of your life you've digested a set of what you would regard as truisms, and you're too busy to, you know, you've got kids, you've got a life, blah, blah, blah. And then when you sit down to write almost every week, illusions that I thought were real were shattered. And there are many, many stories. I suppose the thing about storytelling is, and I've always felt is, you know, the way humans communicate is with stories. When you have a kid that's upset at night and is afraid of the world, you come in and you sit beside that baby or that little boy or little girl and you tell them a story. And that calms them down. And you play with their magic. I've never seen a kid being calmed down with algebra. Okay? Right? Think about it, okay? So economists deploy algebra and mathematics, all the stuff I can do, right, to bully people. Not to elucidate, not to make calm. And I think the whole point of education is to reduce people's anxieties about not knowing things and explain to them in the way in which our forefathers explained the world, which was sitting around a campfire, telling stories, flirting, having a laugh, but telling stories. So a lot of the stories in the book come from that urge to defang or to expropriate economics and give it back to the storytellers. Because that's where I think you achieve the objective, which is to try and spread knowledge and hopefully a little bit of wisdom and arm the reader with some tools to understand the world. And The Wizard of Oz is a bizarre story because it is the single most successful Hollywood production ever. Still. The Americans watch it on Christmas Day and on the day that nobody else understands, except Americans, called Thanksgiving. I have no idea what it is. When it's on. No, I couldn't tell you. It's in April. I don't know when it is, right? Okay. I think it's in November. Okay. So what's this about? So we go back to storytelling. I thought for many years The Wizard of Oz was an American fairy tale. Okay? And that's how it was marketed. And when American families sang, you know, Over the Rainbow together, they thought they were communing in a fairy tale. But in actual fact, it's an allegory about money. This is the amazing story. So if you look at The Wizard of Oz, so the Yellow Brick Road, it's about the gold standard, which was the system of finance that the Americans had in the late 19th century. And it's all based on an election, interestingly, in 1896, which delivered a president called McKinley, who Donald Trump loves, ironically, right? So it always comes back to the guy with the orange face, okay? So what was it about? Very briefly, American farmers and in the South and in the West wanted America to adopt silver as the money, not gold. Why did they want to do that? Because gold is expensive and silver is less expensive. And if you adopt a silver standard, you can print more dollars. And if you print more dollars, you begin the process of getting money into the hands of more people. Now, why were they upset about this? Because people with a farming background who are listening to this podcast will know that farmers are always short of cash between the sowing and the harvesting, right? In fact, one of the earliest reasons we have credit was to basically allow farmers to eat during this period when they'd sowed, but they'd no money, and they're waiting for the harvest. So nature dominated the monetary cycle. So those farmers in the West and poor black and white farmers in the South were very much against the elite and the gold standard. And the allegory is the following. Dorothy is the daughter of a Midwest farmer from Kansas. Kansas is the dead center of the United States. In fact, Kansas is where the average American lives, so much so that if you want to introduce a product in America these days, you always launch it first in Kansas to see, is it going to work?
If it takes.
If it takes, yeah. Yeah. So Kansas, right, farming community. Dorothy is the wholesome daughter of the American farmer. Her dog, Toto, Toto stands for teetotaler because they didn't drink, right? There was a movement, a evangelical Christian movement. The Catholics weren't really part of it, which was an anti-booze movement. The Wizard of Oz, the Yellow Brick Road is the gold standard. So it's a road paved with bricks.
That they have to stay on.
They have to stay. Exactly. The Wizard of Oz himself is nothing more than a fictitious power base behind the throne, okay? And, of course, the OZ stands for the ounce of gold. The Emerald City is green because it stands for the dollar. The Tin Man is the American industrial worker. The Straw Man is the American farmer. And, interestingly, the Cowardly Lion was a guy in reality called William James Bryan, who was the presidential candidate who was defeated by McKinley. And the allegory suggests that he was a great guy, but was a coward. And we see that in politicians all the time. They can talk like a great game, but they don't have the balls to do the hard stuff, okay? So the entire thing is based on how the liberation of the average American person will come when Dorothy, the farmer's daughter, is victorious over the Wizard of Oz, which is the financial elite who hold gold. And that's what the thing is all about, which is kind of amazing. That Americans watch this show and they've no idea. It's all about economics. So economists should be talking like this to their kids in university because you're making connections in their heads.
I mean, I felt that way. When I finished reading the book, I actually, for a small moment, thought if somebody had explained economics and money and society in this way, maybe I would have chosen that.
No, but
it really did. It really did just shift quite fundamentally for me.
Well, the way that's that wonderful
we're looking at it, you know, I think this is the fantastic place, this particular story with Dorothy and how to unshackle ourselves from some of the things that are in our brain.
It's only in our brain. This is the thing. If you really, really think about this, money is an illusion in our brain. And it has an ability, if we end up being able to deploy it properly in our own lives, forget about the society, to actually elevate our position. So the reason writing a book like this is so satisfying for someone like me is that you begin the process of telling people or explaining to people how they can understand money. It's not a self-help book. It's a history book. It's slightly, it's not, you know, read this and you're going to be very rich. It's the opposite. It's read this and you're going to say, wow, my God, this is the way the world works. But I think that we come back to this basic idea that money is something that people use every single day. It's the one thing, think about the amount of connections you've had today or you will have today with people who've never met with strangers using money. It is this connective tissue that binds us all together. I've always thought it's a bit like language, that money is like language. For money to be successful, it has to be like a language. So you think about the English language. The reason the English language is successful is because people default to it. So here in South Africa, I'm always amazed at how extraordinary linguistic ability the average person has. But we default to English so we can communicate. So the more we use English, the more powerful the language becomes. Money is the same way. The reason the US dollar is important and the rand is not is because the Americans have created a world where we use the dollar like we use English. So you think about this. When a South African company in rand is exporting copper, for example, to a European country that uses the euro, we have to square the trade in dollars, which gives the Americans an extraordinary advantage, mm-hmm. right? That's all going to change in the future. But my point is that money becomes beautifully elegant and fascinating when it's used, not when it's hoarded, ironically.
Mm.
And the point of the book is to try and allow people or give people the permission to break out of some of their misapprehensions. So we use money every day, but very few of us really understand it. And most of us are kind of afraid of it.
Yeah.
That's the interesting. We're kind of afraid of it. Its power, its mystique, what it does to us, which we may or may not like. And as a result of that, we outsource thinking about money to, we spoke about Brahmins and high priests, to the economist class, who are the high priests. And that, in a way, emasculates people, I believe. So hopefully the book goes a small way to helping people understand the world around them.
I hope you go out, get the book, read it. It's amazing. It's fascinating. There's so many stories and so much in it that will blow your mind, like the Dorothy story. But also you get a commercial break to tell people about your podcast, because there's more than just the book.
There's more than just the book.
There are many books. So you have a couple of books, but this was incredibly fascinating. And I loved in the foreword that it says, the way that you've written the story is money seems to be in a relay race between charlatans
and cheats.
Charlatans who pass it to cheats who in turn pass it to... And so tell the people about your podcast and then...
So the podcast is called the David McWilliams Podcast. It is bi-weekly, so twice a week. It comes from Dublin. It's myself and my oldest mate, who's a sound engineer by trade.
Oh.
And he and I grew up in the same street. So we've known each other since we were three, which is a long, bloody time. And so John acts as the sort of the everyman. The guy who's like, well, I try to explain things, and it's very international, the podcast. Yeah. In fact, today's one is all about South Africa. We recorded it yesterday. And if you want to hear more of this sort of stuff, just go to or Google the David McWilliams Podcast, as the Americans say, wherever you get your podcasts. I don't know why people end up this podcast things. And you'll find it on the usual platforms.
I have loved every minute of this, and
it's
like gold. This conversation, I was so looking forward to it, and I'm so glad you made the time.
It's my pleasure. It's my absolute pleasure. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.